You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, September 16th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So, Kara, your whole side of the country is on fire over there, huh?
Not good, I should
say. Very bad.
How are you doing?
I'm okay. So I live in East LA, just below and to the west of Pasadena. So I'm like southwest of Pasadena in a neighborhood called Eagle Rock. And there is a fire called the Bobcat Fire, which is burning De Angelis National Forest right now.
That.
And actually encroaching on Mount Wilson, which is really sad
That's
and scary. I know. I mean, there's so much history at Mount Wilson. And it has made the air quality for our area quite bad. You know, usually it's unhealthy to very unhealthy, according to like the National Weather Service's kind of standards in my area, but it's nothing compared to one of my best friends lives in Eugene, Oregon, and it's hazardous outside there.
So what does that mean to like everyday life? What can't you do?
Oh, so when I go outside now, first of all, I'm not walking my dog except to let him go to the bathroom quickly and bring him back in. So I'm not really leash walking him like I usually would around the neighborhood. When I go outside, I'm only wearing an N95 mask. I'm not wearing like one of my cloth masks. I'm not doing anything that would require any sort of, I don't know, heavy breathing outside. I'm mostly just getting the mail, letting my dog out, coming back. I'm lucky that I have central air. So I'm running my AC a lot, and I just put in new filters. I run my extraction fans. But there are people in LA who don't have air conditioning, and that's a double whammy because it's hot as hell outside.
Jeez,
oh my God.
Ugh.
But it's like you can't open your windows because it burns your eyes. And the other thing that's frustrating is there's so much ash on the ground. So like as there's just ash coating everything. So like when my dog does walk outside, he has a tendency to stick his little nose on the concrete and like sniff kind of in the in the gutters. And he keeps breathing in all this ash and sneezing.
Oh, gosh.
I know. I'm like, no, killer, don't do it. But when you look at, I'm going to look at the numbers now. So if you were to open your weather app, it would say that right now, which is Wednesday at 5 p.m., unhealthy air quality for sensitive groups, 91 degrees. So our air quality index is only 119, which is lower than it has been in days. The air quality index in, you know, around Portland and parts of Eugene, Oregon, has been like 400, 450. Like, don't go outside. It's hazardous to breathe the air outside. I think that I read an article recently that said that it was the worst air quality in the entire world.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that too.
Ugh. Yeah. So I guess part this is kind of what it was like for a lot of people living in Beijing, but a little bit worse.
Well, we're going to talk about the forest fires a little bit later in the show, but let's get to our COVID-19 update. So when we recorded the show last week, news just broke about the vaccine trial being paused in the UK, the AstraZeneca vaccine.
Oh, yeah.
So right.
We didn't really have a lot of information about it other than that bare fact. So we do have some further information. The good news is that the vaccine trial is restarted, and
cool.
Independent Review Board
really?
Said that it was safe to restart the trial.
Nice. So it seemed like it was just this one isolated person.
Well, the thing is, that's like a nicely ambiguous way of stating it. It's safe to restart the trial.
Yeah, but like what does that even mean?
They're deliberately not releasing information, and they say because they don't want to bias other trials or other researchers, and also there's a patient confidentiality.
Is there truth to that?
Well, there is a HIPAA concern there.
Yeah, there's definitely a HIPAA concern.
Yeah.
But it was unofficially stated that the side effect, the potential side effect, the adverse outcome that the person had was transverse myelitis. Now, I haven't read anything to say that that's not true, and so that seems to be the case. And what that is inflammation of the spinal cord.
The
background
severe.
Rate of that now, but I mean, what I mean by background rate is just people getting transverse myelitis who don't have
out of the blue,
don't have like multiple sclerosis or some background disease where that would cause it, and that's about 3 to 4 per million per year, right? So,
okay,
if you say 30,000 people are getting the vaccine, that would be a 10% chance that one of them would come down with transverse myelitis over a year, you know, over 3 months, it would be a quarter of that. So it'd be
you're
like
saying that
would
be the background rate.
Yeah, the background rate would be you would expect 2.5% chance one person would crop up in the trial so far with transverse myelitis, something like that, right? Something on that order of magnitude, you know, single digits percent. But again, that's the lottery fallacy, right? So don't just consider what's the probability of transverse myelitis. You have to consider what's the probability of anything cropping up during any background. You know, they could have been optic neuritis. It could have been, you know, whatever. It could irritable bowel syndrome. It could have been anything, any of a thousand things. So they have to look at what's the total rate of potential adverse events in the population, the people getting the vaccine, over the course of time, and is it collectively in the background rate, and also individually, is there nothing that is really defying the odds? You know, like something with a 1% chance of happening, sure, that's fine. When you have thousands of people in a trial, you're going to see 1% things cropping up, right? But
is the rate significantly more than that?
But if the probability gets to be like, oh yeah, it's like thousands to one that these three people would have had this same. You know, if you get two people with the same one, it's a totally different thing. Hmm. And so, again, they just said it's safe to restart the trial, which is not the same thing as saying that this was definitely not caused by the vaccine, because it's totally plausibly a side effect of a vaccine. Especially, again, where the concern here is that coronavirus in particular and COVID-19 in particular has a pretty extreme immune response, you know, and the immune response in a lot of ways causes more damage than the infection does. And so the concern is that if you give enough of a reaction to the vaccine to protect against SARS-CoV-2, might that also cause enough of an immune reaction that it would cause an adverse, you know, inflammatory side effects? So that's why we need to do these phase 3 clinical trials. We absolutely need to do it because it's totally plausible. And this is why it takes years to develop vaccines, you know, it's because they don't necessarily hit the bullseye right out of the gate. You got to study these things and make sure that you're in that sweet spot where you're getting enough protection to make it worthwhile without provoking any adverse effects. So hopefully this is background, you know, this is nothing, and the trial is moving forward and didn't really lose any time. They're on schedule, and I haven't heard any of these from the other trials that are going on. So we're still hoping that, you know, by the end of the year, you know, one of these vaccines will get over the finish line and we'll be able to start giving it to the high risk people and then start rolling it out more broadly next year. Right. That's kind of the optimistic timeline. We're still that optimistic timeline is still feasible. This is a blip. But, you know, is this a blip or is this the first sign of a problem, you know, that we won't know until the other shoe drops? Right.
So or it doesn't. What do we need to see for us to feel like this is a problem? More cases of this specific
or closely situation? Related, like, okay. It's of some of this or something like it, you know, where if you start to get an increase in inflammatory episodes, you know, otherwise isolated inflammatory episodes in people who don't have any a chronic inflammation, of course they wouldn't be in the trial if they did, right? You're not going to take somebody with an autoimmune disease in a vaccine trial. Yeah, so if more starts cropping up and then statistically the independent reviewers like, yep, this is starting to get above background. We need to halt things and take a closer look at it or whatever. Or just stop it and say, nope, got to go back to the drawing board.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me, and obviously it makes perfect sense. You just said, like, you know, we wouldn't put somebody in a vaccine trial who has a pre-existing autoimmune condition, but how does that bode for people who do have autoimmune diseases when the vaccine, if and when the vaccine becomes widely available? Because we know it was never tested on them.
Yeah. So the answer is we do it with caution. Right. So generally speaking, if you have an autoimmune disease, if you are on immunosuppressive drugs, which those two things tend to go hand in hand, because the last thing you want to do to somebody who has an autoimmune disease is stimulate their immune system, right?
Mm-hmm.
The risk versus benefit calculation is different. So we generally say, don't get the vaccine unless the disease the vaccine is preventing is life-threatening and you're in a high-risk group. So then, you know, so the benefit of the vaccine has to outweigh the theoretically increased risk.
Tough with a new disease.
Yeah, right.
Like a novel. Right. Yeah. Oof.
Yeah. So
those are the people that rely on herd immunity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. that's why if you are healthy and able to get the vaccine, like you have a duty, in my opinion, to get it, because you need to protect those people who for medical reasons cannot, or the risk would be much greater for them. But even still, you know, like if you're for the flu vaccine, which is the one that comes up every year, like I have patients who have autoimmune disease, and the question is, do I get my flu vaccine? And the answer is, if you really need it, but not if you're in a low risk group, then don't bother. The risk versus benefit isn't there. This last week, the world had its greatest number of new COVID-19 cases in a single day since the beginning of the pandemic.
Wow.
Kind of puts things in perspective. Like we had our biggest single day ever just this past week. I think that's probably because it's surging in India, and India has a huge population.
Huge.
Yeah. So
yeah, it would do it.
Yeah. Plus it's still at high levels. It's kind of again plateauing in the US, but it's plateauing at a level that's higher than we were back in April and March when we were shut down. Mm. We're plateauing at around 40,000 new cases per day. We're rapidly approaching 200,000 deaths in the U.S. So we had a question. Somebody asked us about we give the absolute numbers. What about the relative numbers? The often quoted statistic for the U.S. is that we have 5% of the world's population, but 20% of the world's cases of COVID.
I thought it was 25%.
Is it 25%?
It's high. I remember it being like, wow, okay. 4% of the world's population, but 25% of its coronavirus cases. But that was back in June. Okay, still the U.S. case numbers remain at the top of the global chart, accounting for almost a quarter of the 25 million cases. Yeah, so almost 25%, and we're 4% of the world's population.
Yeah, we're not doing well.
Nope. And I think the thing is, too, that sometimes when people write in, we got a few emails from people saying, hey, why aren't you talking about things per capita? Why are you constantly just giving raw data for America and not comparing, because it comes across to us like you're saying America's doing well, which we have never said.
Wow.
I think the issue is that the vast majority of our listeners are in the U.S., and we are often giving U.S. statistics because that's what we have the most up-to-date access to, and that's also the most relevant for most of our listeners. But we're in no way doing that to say, look, America's doing great. If anything, we're the leading or trailing, I guess it's a better way to put it. We're doing worse than almost every other developed nation.
Mm-hmm. It's obscene. It's obscene how bad we're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just to make it perfectly clear, like, yeah, we're complaining about where the United States is. We're horrified where the United States is when it comes to coronavirus.
Yeah, it was botched. And there's a lot of really good coverage on that. I think probably Ed Yong's article in The Atlantic that just came out this last week is one of the most concise and best researched, I think, deep dives into like all the policy points where the U.S. failed. Like what went wrong to get us to this place? It's really well laid out in that article.
And it was totally predictable and totally preventable.
Absolutely.
Completely. So speaking of which, I think this is related. For the first time in its history, the magazine Scientific American has endorsed a candidate for president. They endorsed
175 years, guys.
Yeah, 175 years. They endorsed their first candidate. They endorsed Joe Biden. But I think it's mainly because that Donald Trump is anti-science. You know, they
endorse not Trump.
Yeah, they endorse, like, for example, not the anti-science guy.
Yeah, editor-in-chief Laura Helmuth said that a 175-year tradition is not something you break lightly. We'd love to stay out of politics, but this president has been so anti-science that we can't ignore it.
Yeah, so they're basically saying this is... Yeah, this is the not Trump endorsement. Yeah, and who knows if that'll move the needle? You know, probably not. I think people, it's pretty locked in at this point. But yeah, you know, again, we're not political too. You know, we try to stay apolitical. Doesn't mean, you know, and to clarify, that doesn't mean that we don't talk about issues that have a political angle. It means we talk about it as objectively as we can, and not from the perspective of our personal political ideology as much.
Right.
As
when
we
you
can.
Say
we try to be good.
You mean the SGU's editorial policy, not us individual
yeah, right.
people.
Individually, we can do whatever we want, but that's the SGU. We're talking about the SGU as editorially. We're like Scientific American. We're science, critical thinking, media savvy, and we want people of all political and even religious persuasions to listen to us.
Yeah, so absolutely.
We're not anti-religion per se. We're just we're pro-science, but whatever that means, and if that happens to conflict with your political beliefs or your religious beliefs or your social beliefs, too bad. You know, that's
right.
You don't refrain from going there, but we talk about science critical thinking and not personal belief.
That's right.
Personal ideology. Again, we're human. We're imperfect, but we do the best we can. And we do try to keep each other honest. And honestly, without getting into details, there's a pretty good range of political background and opinion on this show.
Yeah, given that we're all like kind of evidence-based first, and that's really where the position we come from, it's interesting how far our economic ideologies, our social ideologies actually do range.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so don't think you can pigeonhole all of the SGU into one political narrow, you know, label. You can't, as much as people try to do that.
Right. I mean, we need a leader who is a fact-based leader, and we can argue all day about how important it is to have evidence-based policy. You know, we know that we don't have a great track record of that in the U.S., and we'd like to see more evidence-based governing. But it's beyond the pale when you get to a point where basic truth and fact is being twisted and being presented as non-truth and vice versa, that like literally invented ideas are being presented as if they are evidence-based. And that's a very dangerous, it's a post-truth. What's the word I'm looking for? Like when I think of all of my favorite kind of mid-century sci-fi dystopian novels, like this is what many of them are harping on.
Well, another way to look at this is that the way to stay apolitical is to not inject your value judgments, right? So evidence-based, you know, logic-based, yes. But when relative value judgments intrude, now you're making personal, you know, political choices.
Right. Yep.
But there is a limited set of values that we endorse just as skeptics. And one of those is a respect for facts, a respect for truth, a respect for science as an institution. Mm-hmm. And so when somebody, you know, goes against those principles, then those are value judgments that we will defend. We defend that, you know, the truth matters, reality matters.
It matters.
Right?
And when you publicly undermine the scientific voices within an administration and you try to undo the good work that the scientists are doing and sow distrust in the population, that becomes detrimental to science literacy and to trust in the institutions, which are foundational to democracy. We have to trust scientists when scientists are operating within a society where they are allowed to have, you know, free speech and freedom of ideas. We have to be able to trust that there's consensus there. And also we have to be able to some extent, put our faith in the fifth estate, right? Put our faith in the fact that high quality journalists are doing their jobs. And when when we have an administration that sows distrust in the media and in the scientific establishment, people start to lose sense of what's real. And that's very dangerous.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on. Bob, you were going to do a forgotten superhero of science. You haven't done one in a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. Looking forward to this. For this week's Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I will be covering Dr. June Almeida, 1930 to 2007. She was a Scottish virologist who was the first person to identify a human coronavirus.
Wow.
Almeida grew up near Alexandra Park in the northeast of Glasgow. She had little money in post-World War II Scotland for a formal education, but she was able to get a laboratory technician job in histopathology at Glasgow Royal Infirmary. And I remember reading that in and of itself sounded pretty amazing for a woman in the 1940s or 50s. She later moved to Toronto and worked at the Ontario Cancer Institute and developed her formidable skills with an electron microscope. So those skills then got her recruited in 64 at the St. Thomas Hospital Medical School in London. There she worked with Dr. David Tyrrell, who was researching the common cold, probably before he started building replicants. As part of that research, they succeeded in growing some common cold viruses, but some just would not grow. They showed that one sample called B814 was different from other cold virus samples. When they examined them, they were able to determine that they had a lipid coating and they would not transmit typical cold symptoms like a sore throat, but it did make people feel an unusual malaise. They could not get it to reproduce in the run-of-the-mill cell cultures that they used, so they tried an organ culture and that worked. They were able to make it reproduce in quantity. So the next obvious step was to take a closer look at the new virus, But when Tyrell had the sample sent to Almeida for imaging, he was skeptical the electron microscope could see the new virus. He thought that it would have to be a lot of the virus, and it would have to be exceptionally pure to even see with an electron microscope. Did not think it could be seen, not yet anyway. And he thought this even though he was told that Almeida was seemingly extending the range of the electron microscope to new limits. And Almeida herself was confident that the new techniques she had developed over the years could tease out a distinct image, and she was right. Tyrell wrote that the results exceeded all our hopes. She recognized all the known viruses, and her pictures revealed the structures beautifully. But more important, she saw virus particles in the B814 specimens. So what she saw before anyone else was a human coronavirus, which she later, Tyrell and the hospital bigwig Professor Tony Watterson, they later officially named it coronavirus because of the distinctive halo-like a solar corona around it on the first viral image of it ever taken. A different meaning of the word viral image than that is common today.
Yes, indeed.
So an amazing first that helped accelerate research on a type of virus that now has the entire world in its grip. So remember June Almeida, look her up online to see even more contributions she made to virology. There was a lot of them. Mention her to your quarantine friends, perhaps when discussing zoonosis or HCoV-229E, or obviously, angiotensin-converting enzyme 2.
Right, that last one is a good one.
Yeah, that's the one that I'm usually discussing with my friend.
That's right.
Yeah, not one, enzyme 2.
Hey, Bob.
One was impressive, but two.
How many emails do you think we'll get about how you pronounce Glasgow?
Oh, damn. Did I
feel like that's our most common type.
Did he say Glasgow?
He said Glasgow, I think. Or maybe he said Glasgow, I don't know.
So what the hell is it now? I don't even know what it is anymore.
Most people that don't live in Glasgow call it Glasgow, like a Z.
Yeah,
Glasgow. And then like a go. But if you're a Glaswegian, you have like a really weird accent.
Glaswegian.
And I can't even emulate it. It's something like Glasgow. Like I can't do it.
But it's Glasgow, really, but Glasgow, like with a Z G-O.
It's fun. Like Chilliwack. Sorry, guys.
Oh, yeah.
Chilliwack.
Chilliwack. Are they chill in Chilliwack, or do they make chili in Chilliwack? That's what I want to know. All right. Evan.
Yeah.
This is the biggest news of the week.
Big.
One of those things, well, you know, it could go in different directions. But did scientists find signs of life on Venus?
Venus, of all places. My gosh. Oh, boy, we talk about the search for life beyond the Earth so much on this show. And this is, we're adding a new candidate. Or rather, more accurately, it's an old candidate that suddenly has brand new appeal, is really what happened here. So we talk about life elsewhere in our solar system. We've talked about so much on the SGU, Mars countless times, Enceladus, which is a moon of Saturn. We've talked about Europa, moon of Jupiter. But Venus, I think perhaps the only context we've really talked about life on Venus is how bad a candidate Venus appeared to be for types of life. And it went ignored. We've ignored our closest neighbor for far too long, apparently. Thank goodness there are great people working in planetary sciences who are not ignoring Venus. So led by Professor Jane Greaves at Cardiff University, she and her team turned their modern instruments to Venus and discovered something amazing. Yep. All right. June 2017, using the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope in Hawaii, they went looking for biomarker gases on Venus. Now, specific molecules will absorb light coming through the clouds at different characteristic wavelengths. And through this process, phosphine was detected. And that was
spectroscopy. We should just say that's like a standard technique of identifying elements and compounds in other in distant stars, different worlds. Yeah,
so see what's missing.
Yep, see where the absorption lines are, and where the absorption lines are, you can detect the chemical analysis by that.
Yeah. Well, there's either emission lines or absorption lines. Like it's glowing, there's emission lines. If light's passing through it, there's absorption lines.
Right.
This was unexpected. To the best of our scientific understanding, the chemical phosphine, which is comprised of one atom of phosphorus topping a base of three hydrogen atoms, this chemical compound, at least on Earth, is only made by humans artificially or by anaerobic bacteria, generally in rotting corpses, but it's also present in things like fecal matter and worms and, you know,
all that other good stuff.
But certainly, you know, here on Earth, two things. We either make it or it naturally occurs through through life. Phosphine has been detected on other planets in our solar system in the atmospheres of Jupiter and Saturn. But this is due to the immense heat and pressure that jams the phosphorus and hydrogen atoms together to form the molecule. But on the four inner planets, our rocky planets, non-gas giant planets, it's a totally different thing. Well, we know how phosphine comes about on Earth. And, you know, I read that in Breaking Bad, and I have to admit right now or confess that I've not watched the series.
Ah,
but
wow,
apparently,
really? But, right now and watch it.
Okay, let me get back to you in a couple weeks when I'm done. So Walter White created this compound to kill people because it's a poison, apparently.
Really?
Oh, in the first episode?
That's what I read. Now,
no,
I couldn't confirm that.
He wasn't killing anybody in episode one.
Oh, wait. Yeah.
Walter White was dying of cancer for like the whole first half of the season.
No, this was.
He got better.
They were in their meth vehicle and they. People.
We can't get into the side.
Right. I'm sorry.
Okay.
The point is that either people manufacture it or it's known through biological processes or unknown processes. And that's kind of what you have right now. Those are your candidates. So what they did, what the scientists tried, they tried to validate their findings. So, or invalidate them for that matter. So Greaves and her team in March of 2019 used a more powerful telescope. This is the Atacama Large Millimeter Array in Chile. And they pointed it at Venus and they ran the analysis again. And not only did it come back with phosphine again, but the ratio was upwards of 20 parts per billion, which maybe doesn't sound too impressive, but it's actually quite impressive. That's several thousand times more than we find in Earth's atmosphere. And we know what the source is here on Earth of the phosphine is. So could there be another molecule which absorbs the light in that spectral analysis? Maybe. But for now, you have to go with this is phosphine. This is what is in the Venus atmosphere.
Yeah, but Evan, so the authors, though, were very clear. And I think this is a good example of really great science, where the authors tried to answer they were their own worst skeptics, right? They tried to answer any objections to the data and the tentative conclusions that they were coming to.
They tried to falsify it, effectively.
Yeah, they tried to falsify this idea, because they went looking for phosphine, say, as a biomarker for life. They wanted to make absolutely sure that they found phosphine and it wasn't something else. They really explored every other possibility. So I think it's pretty solid that there is actually phosphine in the atmosphere of Venus.
Mm-hmm.
Now the question then becomes, where's it coming from?
Yeah, how to get
there. They addressed that too, but of course,
yeah,
not with a definitive answer, but tell us about that part.
Phosphine could have been created, say, from volcanic activity or lightning in the Venus atmosphere or other natural geological processes on the surface of the planet. Maybe meteorite activity was even suggested. And if you read Phil Plait's blog post about this, he does a really nice job of kind of breaking down all these different other possible ideas behind it. But the quantities just aren't there. In fact, what Phil said is that if you're going to look at volcanic activity, you would have to detect about 200 times the amount of volcanic activity that we're aware of on Venus to even reach the lowest estimates of phosphine
in the atmosphere.
So they were pretty effectively able to knock those out. What that means is, and I'll put it in the kind of the visual diagram of a pie chart. All right, you got this pie chart. All right, and you have organic life is one little slice of it, but you have the volcanoes and you have the lightning and you have all these other little slivers of what it possibly could be. And you also have a chunk which is called unknown. You have to mark that as unknown. Well, you can probably pull away those slices of volcanic activity, the lightning, the meteor activity and all that, but it gets filled with unknown. It doesn't mean that you have this much, much greater super chance of this being life. You have to, for now, until they can do more analysis, consider it unknown. So they are, and Steve, you alluded to this earlier, they're being properly skeptical. They're using proper skepticism when they released these papers and made their findings. They are by no means saying that this is life. They're saying we need more information, more data. We need to start looking at Venus as a real candidate now and doing more science to try to narrow this thing down.
Right. The best they could say is basically that this is either life on Venus, or it's brand new chemistry, or it's something happening on Venus that we have no idea is happening on Venus.
Unknown.
Right, It's one of those three, basically.
And I think they make actually a pretty strong case that life is a good possibility here. Yep. So let me just dive a little bit deeper because I did write about this. So the when you're talking about like how much phosphine there is in the atmosphere of Venus, you have to consider how quickly it would be destroyed.
Yes.
Now the problem is there's a lot more oxygen in not like free oxygen like you can breathe, but like just oxygen in chemicals on Venus and in the atmosphere than there is hydrogen. And the phosphorus is very reactive with oxygen. And so it would very quickly react with oxygen. And it would preferentially react with oxygen over hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can calculate, which is what they did, how much phosphine would have to be made in a steady state in order for, accounting for the rapid degradation in combination with oxygen, in order for there to be a steady state of 20 parts per billion. And it's a lot. You would have to make a lot of this stuff, relatively speaking. And they also calculated, now if it's from an unknown abiotic source, right? Unknown abiotic source, meaning not life, but it's some chemistry that's unknown. You could still, even though it's unknown, you could still calculate like how much energy would this process require? And they concluded that there wasn't enough energy available to account for the rate of phosphine production that would be necessary to maintain a steady state of 20 parts per billion. So it's not just that we don't know like a process that could create it. It doesn't seem like the thermodynamics even allow for the abiotic creation of it. Now, you would need something like life to enzymatically reduce the energy necessary to make it. That's why bugs can crank it out on Earth. Or you need like the super high pressure to create the energy like on Jupiter and Saturn, which you don't have on Venus. Now, they're not saying it's impossible that there's an abiotic source. It's just that it's really hard. There would have to be something, not just unknown, but really funky going on.
Basically, new chemistry.
Right.
Yeah, and when you say abiotic, they break that down into photochemical or geochemical, right?
Uh-huh.
Either it's being made by light energy or it's being made under the ground by some kind of geological process. They just couldn't come up with one that would create it. So again, their reaction is like the scientist who said, we think we detected neutrinos going faster than light, but we must be wrong, so help prove us wrong.
Right.
And so they're kind of, that's the
correct
stage that we're at. They're saying to the community, yeah, we can't figure out any abiotic way that PH3 could be being made on Venus, but help us figure it out. Like, what are we missing here? It does become an argument by exclusion, right? It's like, well, there's not positive evidence for critters on Venus. It's just that we have this biomarker and we can't figure out any other way that it's getting there. But it's a pretty, it's very intriguing. It's not proof by any means that there's life on Venus, but it's extremely intriguing. It really is better, I think, than a lot of...
It is. It's actually...
The superficial assessment may
a little
make
exciting.
It seem.
Steve, now wasn't this was detected in the upper atmosphere, wasn't it?
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean,
yes,
so this is not, so remember, this isn't like not on the surface of Venus where lead will melt. I mean, this is,
the
upper atmosphere of Venus is actually the closest analog to Earth's atmosphere.
That's right.
That
pressure and temperature.
The entire solar system, right.
I mean, it's full of sulfuric acid, but,
we wouldn't be comfortable there.
But if you could have
oxygen and hydrogen. Rise above the heavier gas.
But the
gas
clouds
layer.
Are sulfuric acid. The clouds are sulfuric acid. The atmosphere is carbon dioxide, and the clouds are sulfuric acid. So, yeah, certainly not like Earth life, but there are extremophiles that on Earth that thrive in those kind of conditions, highly acidic conditions, etc. So it's absolutely plausible that life could survive in that environment, and that they could be floating around in the
dense. Could be floating around.
Oh, man, yeah, we got to be.
Venus.
We got to take the next step. What's the next step is my question.
If it is true, if it all pans out, do astrobiologists have any idea what they'd be looking for?
I mean, I think the assumption is you're looking
microbes.
For microorganisms that are just floating in the clouds.
So they'd be floating. They would be
suspended. Probably suspended in droplets.
Interesting.
So what we need to do is send a probe to Venus that goes through the atmosphere and actually samples the atmosphere.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And NASA's working on one.
Yeah.
They're working on one that they're launching in 2028.
Yep. ESA is working on it.
They said they were already planning it. I don't think we're at the point now where we need to, like, let's rush this out there. We do need to do a little bit more research and move the dial a little bit more.
Yes, this will push the pedal.
This is super promising for microbial life that maybe, you know, could have, that either Earth seeded it or it seeded us, or it arose spontaneously by itself. Which of course
would be fascinating.
Yeah, but right, worst case scenario,
at the very least, there's some really cool new chemistry going on.
There you go.
Cool new chemistry.
Yeah. And it's so close.
Or something happening on Venus that we just did not anticipate at all.
So how far away is Venus? Like, based on the speeds that we could send a probe right now, how long does it take to get to Venus?
It depends on what method you use, but it is the closest approach to Venus gets pretty close. Yeah, but they usually like do multiple sort of loop-de-loops around Earth.
Gotcha.
Or
right.
It depends on how
gravity assists to save fuel and money as usual.
Yeah, yeah.
And waste time.
At 18,000 miles an hour, you can get there in 155 days. Is that what I'm reading?
Gotcha.
So yeah, it's closer than Mars, we'll put it that
doable.
Way.
Doable. Yeah. Yeah. Like we already could probably do it if we had already been working on it for a while.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
Yeah. There have been probes, you know, mainly in the 1970s,
60s and 70s, there were probes. Soviet Union actually landed
Mariner and one Venera.
Yeah. The Soviets do have Venera.
The Soviets landed on Venus?
Yeah, but it didn't last long.
For minutes.
Yeah.
They
knew that. I think they knew that was going to happen. You want to hear this from Phil Plait, which is something I did not know about?
Always.
He said that, interestingly, when observed in ultraviolet, there are weird dark patches in Venusian clouds that are very difficult to explain. A semi-wacky idea proposed a while back is that there are huge clouds of bacteria floating there that absorb the UV light. It's a bit out there, but not too far out there. And here we have phosphine at about the same altitude over the surface of Venus. So, right?
Oh, it's just, man.
You know,
yeah,
these little puzzle
pieces.
It's
all speculation to
it's intriguing. And so here we go. Let's take a look at our closest neighbor.
Yeah, totally.
Let's get serious.
And one final thing, most importantly, I am looking at Wikipedia, looking at the pilot plot for Breaking Bad, and it says... Walt synthesizes phosphine gas with red phosphorus, which causes Emilio and Crazy 8 to pass out after they inhale it.
There
premiere episode, pilot episode of Breaking Bad.
You've got to watch the show, Evan. It's one of the best. It's like top five.
I understand that. And yes, I need to catch up on that.
And a finale that's worthy of the name. Finale.
Yeah, it was not a disappointing finale.
Nope.
Yeah,
tied everything up.
Hard to pull off.
Better than Lost?
Yeah. There's certain things that you shouldn't even bring up.
I will say that Lost is much better a second time around.
Yeah, because you're not disappointed, right?
It's a
All right,
great
Jay,
show.
Tell us about what's up. What's new with the QAnon conspiracy theory?
God.
Oh, boy.
Our responses.
So, Steve, I wouldn't say, like, what's new. It's more of who are they? Let's talk about who they are. Let's talk about what they believe. I think a lot of people have heard about them but aren't sure about the details. So where you guys know where they started, by the way? Where did QAnon, where did they start?
QAnon.
4chan, something like that.
Yeah, it's a 4chan.
4chan,
that's right.
So right there.
Yeah, so on 4chan, what happened was an anonymous person named Q, who claimed to be a high-ranking federal government official, started to release secret information about a conspiracy against Donald Trump. Right? These 4chan messages became known as Q drops or breadcrumbs. You know, they were delivered in this really weird cryptic type of writing that the person or people, whoever is doing it, that they had. And they had a lot of, you know, heavy duty pro-Trump sentiment mixed in with everything that they were writing. If you take a look at the type of information that they release, it's very similar to Loose Change. Remember Loose Change?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The conspiracy about 9/11, the towers falling.
Exactly. I actually fell for Loose Change for about 2 hours until Steve and Perry slapped me across the face.
Slapped it.
Yeah.
They slapped it.
That's like a double slap, you know. You know, what they do is they take shreds of truth and they use them as like the wrapper around just completely insane fabricated lies. So, you know, there's pieces of information that you might recognize and they use those as the hooks to get you to believe. And then, you know, they slowly unfold their crazy, kind of like the Church of Scientology, right? When you go in and you get audited for the first time, you don't know that they believe in aliens that flew over here in DC-10 like airplane. You know, I mean, it gets very crazy as you do a deep dive.
Oh, yeah.
So QAnon was mostly unknown until July 2018 when supporters appeared at the Trump rally in Florida, right? So their first appearance was at some point in 2017. Now in 2018, we see people carrying QAnon signs and nobody knew what the hell it was that even realized that they were there. And then they finally hit the mainstream media during this year. During the pandemic, right? That's when I think most of us heard about them. So proponents started a massive disinformation campaign about the coronavirus. Their websites and social media like had a big surge in visitors because of all this misinformation that they were you know, shoving out onto the web. And even at one point, Trump and his son Eric posted a QAnon meme. They reposted one of their memes. A video called Out of the Shadows. If you guys heard about this video.
Oh, God.
It's not that show that Bob watches.
No.
No. That's what we do in the shadows.
Oh, right.
So they came up with, they have this Out of the Shadows video, and it's been like this supposedly like silent recruiting, you know, platform. But basically, it's a way for people to get introduced to QAnon. And it's another one of those videos, like I told you, that it questions all knowledge, basically saying that the truth you know is only the truth because you were told it was.
Right.
You know, in the video that they're showing you when they're saying that is so ridiculous. Like you're looking at like how everything is fake. Everything is made up and you don't know what the truth is at all. And you like there's them like setting the platform. So when asked, Trump told reporters that he didn't know much about QAnon, but that, and I quote, these were people who love our country. So what is QAnon claiming? At its core, QAnon is a far-right extremist group. They believe that President Trump is fighting a war, a secret war, against the agents of Satan, right? Now, I'm not making this up. These Satan worshipers are pedophiles who run a global child sex trafficking ring run by people in the media and big business and the government. Of course, the government. So my question to you guys is, who knew that pedophiles were just so organized? Mm-hmm. Like, straight up.
Some of them are.
Wow. Yeah, like, in the world,
like the pedophile collective, as you might say it, they're just really organized. Like they're good at controlling the world. I had no idea. So followers of QAnon think that a day of reckoning is going to come. It's known as the storm, and it's coming. And the people in high places will be jailed and killed, literally killed. Apparently, they hate Hillary Clinton as well. Her name is thrown around a lot. You know, she's one of the obvious ringleaders of the Satanist cult, the cabal. So the storm is thought to be imminent by the people who believe in it. And they say that there are thousands of Satan worshipers. They will all be arrested, probably sent to Guantanamo Bay prison. The U.S. military is going to come down with this incredibly horrible, you know, hand on top of the U.S. citizenry and take over the country. And of course, once all of this is over, the U.S. will be a utopia.
It's like a political religion. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
How does it relate to the New World Order conspiracy? Like it feeds into that, right?
I mean, Kara, you know what? This is like the cornucopia of conspiracies because they have so many side shoots and things that they believe. You know, this I'm giving you like the 30,000 foot view, like the basics of it, because it's just way too much to cover. The answer to your question is yes. To everything. Everything fits. Because, and wait, I'm going to tell you why. You're not going to believe.
It's all conspiracy.
You're not going to believe what I'm going to say here. Believers in Q, mm-hmm. or the person behind QAnon, they believe that Q is deliberately putting misinformation into what he distributes, or she, we don't know, in what they distribute to make it harder for people to interpret, right?
Right.
Oh my gosh. So it's like a scene out of The Princess Bride where.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, it's like Nostradamus.
It is the most convenient line of bullshit you ever heard. Like, oh, well, some of it is deliberately misinformation and only the true believers know what the truth is.
Well, that's fundamental to a lot of more fundamentalist religions too, that they're irrefutable by their nature. It's built into the belief system that anything that could show that they're wrong is just a test of your faith, or it's, you know, it's intentionally been misleading.
Right.
Yeah, the devil put the fossils there to fool us.
Totally. Yeah.
So it becomes a self-contained, irrefutable belief system.
Yep.
because it's built into the belief system is a refutation of anything that might challenge the belief system.
Yeah.
But I think the interesting thing about QAnon, like the flat earth or like the other extreme belief systems that we talk about, is not that it's very tempting to react to this by thinking that, oh, these people are just, you know, profoundly stupid. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't really explain it. It's also just, first of all, it's not true. And you know, not to say that there aren't some, you know, disturbed people in the QAnon phenomenon, but that the rank and file are not necessarily dumber by other unrelated objective measures than the background population. And so we need to
pathological
come up with
thinking.
Yeah, we just come up with some other explanation for why otherwise normal people could fall into a belief system that is so patently absurd. It's not just raw intelligence, whatever that is. You know, obviously there's a difficulty in properly defining and therefore measuring quote-unquote intelligence. And I'm not saying they aren't lacking certain critical thinking skills, because I think that's where the real issue is. I think that these are people who are susceptible to these kind of belief systems because of a lack of familiarity with these cognitive pitfalls. You know, they're falling into traps they don't know were there.
And I think susceptibility as a construct has a lot of different factors that feed into it. Like you were talking about, there's maybe some of the Dunning-Kruger issues, like they don't have the logical or critical thinking skills required. But also I think there are, you know, historical trauma situations that can be seen. There are distrust of authority is a huge one that facilitates this.
There's a tendency to engage in intuitive rather than analytical thinking styles. So that's
right.
definitely correlates with belief in conspiracy theories like this.
I also think there's something a little deeper that relates to this idea that there's one person that could save us, even if that one person is actually kind of intentionally sowing the distrust and the chaos so then they can come in and save us. And there does seem to be a personality type that's interested in a prophet or a savior or a strong man. You know, so that for some people, they look at what's happening politically and they might say, this worries me because I've seen this recapitulated in history and this is how strong men start to gain power.
Yeah.
Other people say, no, we need this person. They're the only person that's going to save us from the chaos and the damage, the crime. A lot of times it's like the crime and punishment kind of take on things like, no, we're going to reestablish order.
Mm-hmm.
And that feeds into this conspiracy really, really well. That there's this, what many of these people think of as an amoral cabal that's existing all around us, and somehow everybody's blind to it. They're just okay with it. And there's only one real person that's working their ass off to try and, you know, clean up. But in doing that, they ignore reality, which is scary.
I know. And it is so typical of conspiracy theories. Like, you know, you have to really not have a good understanding of conspiracy theories to fall for one. And that's what's so frustrating here is like we're seeing this unfold. We're seeing the stories come out and what they believe and what's happening. You know, guys, there are people, there are dozens of people that belong to QAnon that are running for U.S. Congress right now. And they think that one of them is actually going to get elected. Like,
oh, yeah, right. Some of them have won in their primaries. And yeah, it's scary.
Wow. Yeah. In Georgia. Yeah. So this is serious business. You know, we have a lot of people out there that are in this level of dangerous thinking. You know, it's when you get to this level of extreme thinking that some of the worst things crimes against humanity get committed. And it does scare me. And I think about like, there's people out there. There's, you know, flat earthers, they don't scare me. They scare me in a very bland kind of way. QAnon is not something to take lightly.
Also already evidence, right, Jay? Like the Pizzagate conspiracy, which feeds into QAnon, it's like a child of QAnon. Somebody actually opened fire in a pizza restaurant. Like, you know, nobody, I don't think there were no victims other than the person who brought the gun.
Well, QAnon supporters have been arrested for making threats to people.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, so there's actual action that has followed some of this thinking.
Let me end with a quote from Voltaire.
Go ahead.
Who said, "Those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities.
Sure, yep. Sure. Right. Heard that exactly, many times.
How old is that bit of wisdom? So it's like people are the same as they were hundreds of years ago. All right, Kara, you're going to tell us about the psychology of lying and cheating.
Right. So this is a field of psychological inquiry that goes back basically to the beginning of experimental psychology, right? Psychologists have always been interested in deception. Doesn't Richard Wiseman have a PhD in deception? Yeah, like he went to a school where you could kind of name your own PhD and pick your course on that. And of course, his has to do more with magic, but a lot of this plays in together. So a new paper said, okay, what we want to do is we want to see if we can sort of beef up and retest some old concepts in the kind of construct of lying, cheating, deception. But we want to go beyond that. And we want to say, okay, this is not an all or nothing phenomenon, right? Like, you could say that person's a liar, or that person lied, or that person's a cheater, or that person's dishonest. But there are shades of gray, aren't there?
Mm-hmm. Of course. Yeah, like, of course.
Yeah. Right. Like white lies.
Totally. There are lies that actually help us.
Lies that get people killed.
Yep. Lies that get people killed, and lies that we can't help but commit. That's not a good word. But tell. Yeah, because right. they're the best of a bad situation we're dealing with, or something like that. So they set up, you know, a standard classic laboratory psychology paradigm, which does not necessarily translate to the real world. So let's keep that in mind. And they set up two paradigms. One of them was a coin flip paradigm, and one of them was a die roll paradigm. And basically they said, you know, if you roll heads, you get money. If you roll tails, you get no money. Or if you flip heads, if you flip tails. And then on the die paradigm, they went into level. So they said, you know, if you roll a one, you get $1, a two, you get $2, a three, $3. But if you roll a six, that's unlucky, so you get no dollars. So those are basically the two experiments that they ran. And they found that people, by and large, had similar response. There were people who were totally honest. So they would flip the coin, they would hit heads, and they would say, got heads, give me my $5. Or they would flip tails, and they would say, you know, I flip tails, I don't get any money. Okay, cool. All right, so you could flip a coin and you're going to be lucky enough that you flip heads. And that's where you get a $5 payout. You're probably going to say, hey, look, I flipped heads. You're going to be honest about that because you want the money. So they decided, let's take all those people out of the equation and let's just look at the people who flip tails. Because now all of a sudden there's incentive, right? You could either flip tails and not get the money and be honest about it. And that is what 41% of the people in the lab setting where they did it in front of actual researchers said. Only 37% of people in a Mechanical Turk situation. So Mechanical Turk, have you guys ever used that? I think it's Amazon's like survey study software. And so this is like, it's a coin flip simulation online. So it was a slightly lower number, it was 37%, but still less than half of the people who flipped tails reported honestly that they flipped tails. Then there was another group that they called the cheating non-liars. I love this. So these people flipped the coin, got tails, and were like, crap, I'm just going to keep flipping until I get heads, which was breaking the rules. The rules was you flip once, but they said, screw it, I'm just going to keep flipping. And then when they finally got heads, they were like, hey, I got heads, let me have my $5. So this was 17% of the people in front of researchers, 7% of the people online. Another group were what they call the liars. So these people flip the coin, got tails, and just straight up go, no, I got heads. 23% of people just straight up lied. And then they found a fourth group, and this group is fascinating, you guys. They called them the radically dishonest people. And this is the group that I'm really interested in, like, can we develop a psychometric tool so that we can test these people and then start learning about them? So these people didn't even bother to flip the coin. They just go, oh, yeah, I got heads.
Whoa.
So it's like they were like double liars. They lied about participating and they lied about the outcome.
What about lying sack of shit? What group are they?
I think that's radically dishonest. Yeah, they're the lying sack of shits. Yeah. And so this is really fascinating because I think there are two components here that we maybe intuitively thought about, just like Bob mentioned earlier. You know, there's the lies that could get you killed. There's also the lies that just feel cruel or they feel like pathologically dishonest. And then there are the lies where it's like, I understand the ethical or moral reason that this person lied. And I think we can start to dig deep into just this very clean laboratory experiment to tease out some of those issues. For example, you've got your straight up honest people. You've got your straight up lucky people. Then you've got your just straight up liars. Okay, those are the three groups that I think we would be pretty comfortable with if we were going to hypothesize what would happen. But the cheating non-liars and the radically dishonest people, again, the cheating non-liars said, well, I didn't get it the first time, so I'm just going to keep trying until I do. So they kind of, yes, broke the rules. That's why they're calling them cheaters. But in a way, it's almost like they tested the system until they could get to a place where they felt morally justified in saying, I reached heads, I get the money.
So that they're like looking for a loophole.
Yes.
So that they can tell themselves they didn't lie. Or they didn't cheat. They were just clever and exploiting a loophole.
I think a lot of us do that in our lives.
Well,
a lot of us. I look back at real world examples of this. You know, I have friends who were in terrible relationships and they might have met somebody else and started a new relationship on the side. But since they were breaking up anyway, they sort of convinced themselves that they were already broken up before they crossed any line so that they can't call themselves cheaters, for example. And I think there are a lot, or we do it a lot with food, right? With cheating on whatever our self-imposed diet restrictions are, or cheating on our self-imposed exercise restrictions. It's a very common thing that we do. It's like we figure out a way to contextualize it so that it's no longer a rule breaking scenario. Mm-hmm. It's now a function of external circumstance or a loophole. But then on the flip side of that, you have this radically dishonest group, which not only straight up just made a bald faced lie, they didn't even engage in the activity. And that is fascinating.
Yeah. Like my interpretation of that, my gut feeling is these are people who don't care about the truth. The truth is irrelevant. What coin do they flip? Doesn't matter. They want head, so they say they make their reality.
Mm-hmm. And like it's beyond even I'm going to try to trick you. Yeah. It's that I'm going to invent reality. In a lot of ways, it speaks to this fundamental kind of philosophy, which is reality is what I make it. And I need to do everything that I can to induce a reality that serves me the best. So I would be interested, and they did not study this in this particular investigation, to see if certain personality traits like narcissism would feed into a radically dishonest group, for example.
Or psychopathy.
Exactly. These situations where somebody's maybe empathy is questionable, or it's been stressed, their sense of right and wrong. I mean, this is a really, really interesting outcome of this study. And just to follow up, they did a similar thing with the dice, because they wanted to look at levels, right? Nuanced levels. Because of course, if you roll a 5, you get $5. If you roll a 1, you get $1. And then if you roll a 6, you get no money. So in a way, let's say the 1 and the 6 or the 5 and the 6 are the exact same as the coin flip. But are people more likely, for example, to say that they did better than worse? And the outcome of that was really interesting because you still have the same groups. You have the honest people, the liars, the multiple rollers or the cheating, you know, liars or whatever, and then the radically dishonest. And they sort of matched up in terms of percentages. But this time, because of levels within each of those categories, some people went for the full $5 and other people sort of tempered their response. And they would instead, what the researchers called, sub-maximize their response. So they would say like, oh, I rolled a 3, even though they only rolled a 1. And it's like, you could have said 5, but instead it's somehow less lie-y.
Wow. It also might be less suspicious.
Less suspicious, maybe, or they would feel greedy, less guilty about it. Exactly. Like somehow it is helping with their own sense of shame, guilt, self-concept, self-worth.
Well, yeah, we all have our breaking points to that degree.
Right. Like, that's beyond the pale. But if I stay just under that line, it's not that bad that I'm doing this. So that's also a really interesting wrinkle that was added to this this study that shows that human behavior is really, really complex. And it's not just about what other people think. It's about how we have to live with ourselves and judge ourselves when we go home at night. And we come up with all sorts of strategies, of course, to make order out of chaos, but also to, I think, modulate maybe our own sense of self-worth and self-efficacy. Just fascinating.
Yeah, very, very cool. And it is always a little surprising how many people do this, although we all know it, right?
Yeah, it's like, and I get it. Like, in a real world setting, you know, we all do things that aren't 100% on it. Yeah, we fudge. But like, I'm always amazed when somebody does something, like when they know they're being videotaped or like they know that this is for a psych study. It's like, okay, cool. You be you, man.
All right. Thanks, Kara. Quickly, so last week we talked about how artificial intelligence, AI, is going to root out deep fakes. And this week I came across a study where these scientists were proposing that we use artificial intelligence algorithms, or AI, in order to fix peer review. It's a very interesting concept. So very, very quickly, we're getting into even more of an issue because of COVID-19, where there's a rush to get as much science out there as quickly as possible. And even a lot of researchers are publishing things online as sort of a preprint. And we have to re-examine the whole concept of this balance, you know, of quality control versus timeliness, especially when there's a sort of emergency like a pandemic. But even outside the context of a pandemic, you know, peer review has been under sharp criticism for a while. So as you guys know, like, peer review is you submit a paper, a scientific, you know, paper to a journal. If it's a peer review journal, the editors will assign it to peer reviewers to go over it and make recommendations in terms of like accepted, rejected with these modifications, or they didn't address these issues. Most of the time they fix certain things. Accepted only after fixes. And so it's a good quality control mechanism for science, but it's not perfect. And we've exposed a lot of instances where stuff got through peer review that absolutely shouldn't have. If you follow Retraction Watch, Retraction Watch is like, the graveyard of articles that got through peer review but shouldn't have, and then they had to get fixed after the fact.
And it runs the gamut from outright fraud all the way to like honest mistakes.
Yeah, honest mistakes, outright fraud, and then a lot of p-hacking in the middle. You know,
a lot of self-deception.
Just like you're saying, Kara, it accidentally dovetails very nicely with your piece in that the most common category are people who are fudging just a little bit, but you have plausible deniability, but they know they're cutting corners, sort of. And as we discussed, they underestimate statistically the impact that has on their study. They think that they're just making the data look a little bit nicer when in fact they're making a negative study positive, and they don't appreciate that. And so where could an AI fit in here? In a number of ways. I think this is a fantastic idea. We definitely will see this in the future. And I think this is something that collectively, you know, journals and whoever would do this needs to put resources into this, universities or what have you. Because think about, there are things that AI is better at than people, right? And that's where it's going to have the greatest impact. People are not great at wrapping their head around vast amounts of data. They're not great at distinguishing real patterns from fake patterns. And they're not great at statistics. You know, we don't have good intuition for statistics. And so whereas AI algorithms could become really, really good at it, you know, they could become very, very good at that. This sort of deep learning, especially if you give them access to vast amounts of data. And so they could, you know, AI could do things like not only pick out, plagiarism, for example, but also could compare a study to all the published studies in real time and say, well, you didn't account for A, you know, B or C.
Interesting.
Or could detect things like these statistics are deviating from a natural statistical pattern. Like, remember we talked about that law where, like, the incidence of leading digits and numbers, for example. Like there's a lot of that.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, there's a lot of that Barners. Sort of thing. Yeah, yeah, where genuine numbers should follow certain statistical rules, and numbers that were fabricated or biased or whatever, it's where something hinky was going on, will reveal the manipulation.
Yeah, like this is too clean. Your outcome is either like it's
yeah, it's too clean.
So rare.
Or,
it's too, yeah.
Or if you, and even going beyond an individual study, looking at the literature, it's like, yeah, you could see like the funnel plot thing where you could see that there's publication bias, or you could detect p-hacking because p-values cluster suspiciously around 0.5, you know, 0.05
yeah.
rather.
And it could also, exactly kind of like based on that p-hacking application, it could do what a lot of people hire statisticians to do because they simply aren't as knowledgeable as they should be in this area,
yes.
where let's say your sample is not normally distributed. Well, then you're supposed to correct that data before you run certain types mm-hmm. of statistics on it. But some people just ignore that step, and that's bad.
Right.
So it might be able to right. say you did the wrong statistics based on your data.
Right, exactly. And so there's a lot of things that that can happen, that do happen, and you know that should happen. I mean, statisticians can do all of this. But the idea is a software, like if a journal had access to the software, they could run everything through it. And mm-hmm. so it would just be, it would give you a much more thorough evaluation of submitted papers and really raise the bar in terms of quality control. So this could be, and again, this wouldn't replace people. This would be an expert system that informs the experts so that they could then know what to look for and know what, it'll red flag things that then need to be evaluated, et cetera. So I think this could be a really, really important tool. And again, like it's AI, it's like off the shelf AI technology would do it. It just needs to be adapted to this particular application. But we certainly have the quote unquote technology to do this. It's also a matter of political will, you know, of journals, you know, wanting to invest you know, in this. Like, and I do think that, you know, pressure could be brought to bear, but also this could be a bragging point for journals. And you know, they could say, "Yeah, we ran this through our AI algorithms to detect for these 300 you know types of bias and fraud and plagiarism, et cetera," and you know, really provide a layer of quality control that is more haphazard now. Right?
That's cool. And anybody listening who's like a young student, right, like a millennial mm-hmm. student, or somebody who's gone back to school, knows that we have like baby versions of that in many classroom settings. When you write a paper, you
yeah.
have to put it through Turnitin
mm-hmm.
or yeah. some software like that, where it looks for like basic things like plagiarism.
Yeah, right.
And it's pretty cool. Like that's almost the norm now for, mm-hmm. you know, and why are the standards for like a kid in a college class writing a review paper in some cases higher than some journals? Like that's not okay.
Yeah. Although journals are doing that. They are putting their papers through the plagiarism detection now. That's already
yeah, most good journals
yeah.
are.
Yeah, good yeah. journals are. Yeah,
yeah
absolutely.
Yeah.
And then for me, one of the most interesting things would be like doing really thorough statistical deep learning kind of analysis and coming up with some kind of marker of this is how likely this hypothesis is to be actually true. And I mm-hmm. think that answer would be radically different than what most scientists would come away with reading the paper. Most scientists do not come away with an accurate view of how likely it is that the thing is to be true. At least in the field of medicine, we greatly overestimate the probability that a treatment works based upon preliminary evidence, just you know, in the aggregate.
Agree.
When a more thorough statistical analysis would show, no, it's actually quite unlikely to be true, taking all things considered. The thing is, we don't do all things considered. We look at the p-value, and if it's significant, okay, it's probably true. It's like, nope, it's still probably not true.
Hopefully, a lot of journals, like psych journals, are mostly moving away from p-values and yeah. we're basically just looking at effect sizes. But I think also it would be interesting to see if the effect size is so, so big.
Yeah.
And something is so striking and like so basically rare, I guess you could say, and such
yeah.
a strong effect, those papers require more critical eyes to say, oh my
yeah.
God, you're making a very bold claim compared to norm. Now we can say, let's see if this holds weight, or, and if it does hold weight, like that's a massively important finding.
Yeah. So if I had to get to the nub of why I am optimistic for AI in this role, people are not inherently good at what we call predictive value, knowing how one piece of data affects the predictive value of whether or not something is likely to be true or not, for example. Whereas deep learning, Mechanical Turk type algorithms are really good at it. So you guys have done the Mechanical Turk thing where, like, think of anyone in existence, and then I'll ask you a series of questions and then guess who you're thinking of. And it gets to the answer very quickly with seemingly scattershot questions because the algorithm knows the predictive value of each of those questions.
Yeah.
And they're very counterintuitive.
Winnowing.
It's very counterintuitive. So in the same way, an AI peer reviewer could know the predictive value of things like effect size and p-value and a Bayesian analysis and number of different multiple comparisons and the particular statistical evaluation that they did. They just put all of that together and say, yeah, there's a 1% chance this thing is actually true. This will hold up in subsequent, you know, research, given all of these variables. And no person can do that. Like, we just do not have, that's not how our brains work. And that would, I think that would be, that could be a game changer, especially in a field like medicine, where we are constantly trying to translate preliminary studies into practice, you know, imperfect data into practice. Okay, let's move on. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. Yeah, so Kara, I figured you'd be someone that might know this.
It's some kind of animalcule.
Is it? Yeah, is it an elephant? It's probably not an elephant.
It's not an elephant.
Yeah.
All right, so John Crane wrote in and said, "Hi, Jay, this week's noisy is the deep, low call of the cassowary. Keep on
those
guessing."
Those are so scary.
That is not that bad of a guess, but you are not correct. Let's move on. A listener named MC or Michael C wrote in, said, "First time writing in, long time listener. I finally know this one. It's a male kakapo sounding off to attract a mate." Anybody know what a kakapo is?
No.
So a kakapo is kind of like it's an owl parrot.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like a cross between a parrot and an owl. They're really cute.
But is it an owl or a parrot?
I believe it's a parrot.
That looks like an owl.
Yeah, or it's a parrot. But anyway, thanks for the email. That is not correct, but you are in the correct category. John Paul Posada wrote in and said, "First, thanks for the great work y'all do. Happy to be doing my small part on Patreon to help you all stay afloat." John, thank you so much for being a patron. He said, "Jay, this is my first guest for Who's That Noisy, so I hope sending it via your form is okay. It's actually on behalf of my 9-year-old son who thinks this weekly noisy sounds like a hippopotamus in the jungle." So a hippopotamus, that's an interesting guess. That's a big animal. That's a big animal. It is not a hippo. So you tell your son to keep on listening and to keep on guessing. And I really tell him I really appreciated him making a guess and having you send it in. But we do have a winner for last week. This is Richard Smith, and he said, "This week's noisy is a call made by a male ostrich involving the inflation of their throat as a way of attracting a mate." Let's listen to that again and picture an ostrich in your head. Now, I know what you're saying to yourself. That does not sound like a noise an ostrich would make. Look up the video. And you'll see. It's really weird. They do this weird thing with their throat. And it's all about sex, people. It's always about sex.
Well, sure.
So anyway, that was originally sent in by a listener named Kevin. Thanks, Kevin, for sending that in. I appreciate it. I have a new noisy this week from a listener named Zoe. I hope you like this one. I thought this one was really cool. It sounds like a single tone, but it is not a single tone. That's my only hint. I would like you to guess Evan, I'd like you to think about this one.
All right.
For no particular reason.
I'll be thinking about it.
Yeah, so if you think you have heard that noisy or you know what it is, or if you heard something cool this past week, you can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Jay, interesting that one of the listeners mentioned Patreon. We have gotten a good pulse of patrons in the last couple of weeks because we asked about it. And thanks to everyone who supports us. Classic members, old patrons, new patrons, we really, really appreciate it. It helps us, keep the lights on and do what we're doing. It has been a little bit of a financially challenging year for us for various reasons. You may notice that there's very few ads in our show. Advertising has kind of dried up. So we really appreciate it if you have the means and you have the inclination to become a patron of the SGU. We would greatly appreciate it. And we have to point out that we're getting awfully close to our 4,000 patron goal. Jay, what happens when we hit 4,000?
Yeah.
Oh my God. See, it's like juice running down my chin. It's we're almost at 4,000. I'm like, you realize what this means. And Steve's like, oh my God, you're right. We got to, this is the 12-hour thing, man. So we were so excited on the phone. I'm like literally laughing. I went from like having my head down going, don't worry, we'll make it through this too. We're going to hit it, man. We're going to hit 4,000. It means we're going to go to the Star Trek Museum. So I have been talking about this for what, 3 years now, guys?
Mm-hmm. Yes, a lot.
Right. So I don't care, right? Kara's like, whatever. Every day get to the point. So the point is this. We had the discussion. We realized like we're within 200 people striking distance. We have no idea how long it's going to take. But I told myself that when we got to this threshold, I really needed to like do it or commit. I'm committing. Okay. Nexus is over. I'm committing. So here's what happened. I called up the guy that owns the Star Trek Museum today. I got him on the phone. I finally got him on the phone.
Sweet.
His name is James Cawley. He's awesome. He has a long, interesting career in film and everything. And it turns out that he ended up building an exact and even better replica of the original Star Trek, the series set. He got the blueprints from the guy that created them. And he duplicated the set, painstakingly duplicated the set, but it's a 4K set. It's a super high resolution set, not the piece of crap that Desilu built.
Wait, what?
50 years ago. Yeah, I mean, when they built sets back then, they were,
balsam wood and scotch tape.
They were low resolution. They didn't have to be super expensive.
So James and I discussed it. I'm sending him the proposal. The good news is we are in negotiation. That's mm-hmm. what's happening right now. It seems like this can happen. There was no red flags that went up. I didn't feel weird about anything. He didn't feel weird about anything. So, but there's a few other things I got to remind you guys. Now, remember the Alpha Quadrant 6 / SGU Star Trek, the original series laser rifle that we designed that was made by David Tremont at Weta?
Weta Works.
Yeah, the laser rifle is still in play. You can sign up to join this contest. And I'll tell you, if you're a patron of this SGU, you are automatically signed up to do this. You also can sign up, without having to do anything, of course, because that's the way it works. We also have to give it away.
Yeah, just go to theskepticsguide.org/T3, and you will see all the various ways to get entries into the contest to have a chance to win the Star Trek style phaser that we designed with David Tremont from Weta. It's really cool. You'll see a picture of the phaser there, all the ways that you could join. And again, reinforcing the fact that the best way to do this is just become a patron of the SGU. You'll get a lot of entries and you'll support our show.
There's other things that'll happen here. So another thing is that if you are a patron of the SGU, we're going to give one or more people, depending on how all this shakes out, will get a completely free ride to come to do this.
Cool.
Meaning that we will include the fee, the cost of the whole day event that we're going to do, the 12-hour show, and your hotel. You're going to have to get yourself there because, there are people that it could cost like $2,000 to fly from Australia. We can't cover that. But you get the idea. There's a good value there. So as a patron, you'll also get entered into that. And we will be coming up with more perks as we go. But this thing is officially on rails. I really feel like it's going to happen. James was actually like sounded like very enthusiastic. So this is going to be good. It's like 9 times out of 10, we're doing it at the museum. I'll know something probably within the next couple of weeks. I'll be telling you more details as they come in. But I'm just putting this on your radar. And, you know, we're 200 people away from getting to this goal. If you want to be a part of that, want to help us get to that, please do it. The SGU could use your help, but also we have a ton of fun stuff planned. All the details coming soon. Steve, come on. Are you excited about this or what?
Yeah, but also we should mention that because of the pandemic, it may be a while that before we can pull this off. So if it's going to be a long time between hitting 4,000 and being able to schedule the 12-hour show at like the Star Trek Museum, we will do an in-studio event to tide you over until we could do that. Because we could do like digital things from our studio whenever we want.
Please go to the website, sign up for the Star Trek phaser rifle giveaway, and please consider becoming a patron. We don't ask that often, but I'm asking now.
All right. Thanks, Jay. All right. Two super quick emails. We got a lot of pushback on my black bear comment.
Yeah.
Oh, Christ. I mean, you scared half the world out there. I mean,
well, listen.
We didn't scare them. We made them feel too safe, apparently.
We've already done a deep dive on the whole bear situation. I didn't think we had to go over it again. So I was sort of talking in the context of this conversation that we already have. But I guess not everybody listens to every episode. So we should, whatever. So the bottom line is that black bears are relatively non-threatening because they're very skittish. They don't really usually have an interest in bothering with people. And if you do come across a black bear, you should make noise and back away. Obviously, you should not try to interact with them in any way. They are wild animals and they're predators. But they're
right, but we were saying they're not dangerous. We weren't saying that they're guppies.
Right.
No, they're saying comparatively. But there are obviously exceptions to that. If you startle a black bear, it's unpredictable how they'll respond. If they have cubs, if they're protecting food, or if they're starving, they may decide like, okay, yeah, I'm going to hunt that guy over there. You know. So
yeah, if they're in a stress situation, don't test them.
But what I said was I'm not worried about the black bear in my neighborhood in Hamden because I'm sure it's got plenty of food, first of all. And it's a very rare visitor and they're not that aggressive. You know, my dog chased it away. So that's probably what would happen. And likewise, you know, I made similar comments about wolves are not the vicious predators that fairy tales make them out to be. Again, they're still wild predators, right? The whole point was you should not provoke them by doing something as seemingly innocuous as feeding them. You should not interact with them at all.
Yeah, that's actually not innocuous, feeding a wild animal.
Yeah, no,
it's kind of one of the worst things you can
do. When scientists say that they're sociable animals, they mean with each other. They don't mean that. The study in question was about heavily socializing them from young pups into human society. Yes, you can sort of transfer their sociability to people if you raise them from the point when their eyes are closed. That's literally what they did in the study. But you come across wild wolves in the wild, stay away, man.
They're not social
predators
with us.
Yeah,
actually,
just to clarify that.
You know, Steve, I made a quick point when you originally were talking about wolves last week about the fox study and following human gaze. Another interesting thing I learned about the fox study, if you guys remember this famous study in Russia where they basically took the most aggressive foxes and bred them together and the most docile foxes and bred them together, that was with regards to how they treated people. So they would take the foxes that would like hiss and bite at people and breed them together. And they would take the foxes that would, you know, be more comfortable being handled and breed them together. And eventually, several generations later, you had the pets and you had these super mean foxes.
Yeah.
But the weird thing is you could put one of the pet foxes and one of the mean foxes in a pen together and they were still perfectly social with each other.
Yeah.
Wow. Right.
It was only how they related to people. So yeah, those are obviously two very different components.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So the second one we were asked, I'm not going to read the whole email, but Derek S. from British Columbia, Canada, asked us about the forest fires. I said we were going to talk about this. The question is, are the forest fires due to global warming or due to poor forest management? And the answer is yes.
Yeah.
It's due to both. It's clearly both. So global warming is, there's more drought, everything is drier, it's hotter, it's more likely to catch fire, the fires are more likely to spread and to burn. So yes, definitely global warming is contributing to the likelihood and the severity of these forest fires. But there is a long-standing issue with forest management as well. And this is complicated, but let me give you just a very, very couple of quick little doodads. So as sort of society has moved into these woods more, we're building stuff, we're building structures more in these areas. We've been trying to prevent fires more aggressively and to not only, you know, prevent forest fires, but also to protect this infrastructure that we're building near and around and within these forests. The problem is that fires are a natural part of the forest ecosystem. And when you aggressively prevent fires, then the combustible material builds up over time. And so you do have to do forest management. You have to do controlled burns. You have to do some removal of wood and stuff. And you have to manage the forest. Now there's a lot of political problems here in the US, whereas like states don't have the money to do this properly. But once they catch fire, then the federal government pays to put them out. And so it's a kind of a perverse incentive almost to sort of like, I'm not saying they're letting them burn, but I'm saying that's what happens because they essentially don't have the funds to properly manage the forests.
But it's not just state level, Steve. The federal government owns a lot of those woods as well.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes, that's complicated.
The states aren't
responsible
for clearing that out.
And historically, there was a will issue too. Like, I think it just flew in the face of human kind of ingenuity to say, oh, forest fire is a natural part of the ecosystem, and we have to allow certain parts or induce certain parts of it to burn in order to manage healthy forest growth.
Yeah.
And so historically, at least, the idea of intentionally burning public land or even private land was anathema. Like, people did not want to do that. And so there's also a culture shift that has to occur.
Interestingly, the local Native Americans deliberately burn the forest as part of their forest management. And I recently heard the term cultural burning, because it was kind of allowed as an exception. Like, they were allowed to do cultural burning, which was actually a good thing for forest management. But partly they also did it because they were trying to change the forest. Some tribes would actually burn the forest because it promotes the growth of oak trees, and then they would harvest the acorns and live off the acorns. So they were actually changing the makeup of the forest for their own ends, not just managing the forest. But still, it was actually better than letting the fuel build up until we have what we have now, which is the worst forest fires in history. So yeah, it's all of the above. Some of the fires started in grassland, so it's obviously not about forest management, you know, when the fires are not even starting in the forest. So it's both. It's the climate, and we have to do a better job at preventing these fires. All right, guys, let's move on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fake, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. These are news items. I just happened to find three news items with a theme. The theme is paleontology. It's a kind of a broad theme. These all relate in some way into stuff in the past. Okay, here we go. Item number one. Archaeologists have found direct evidence that our human ancestors were boiling food in hot springs almost 2 million years ago, 1 million years before the first evidence of cooking with fire. Item number two, scientists have discovered a new mass extinction occurring 233 million years ago and paving the way for the rise of the dinosaurs. And item number three, paleontologists have discovered the oldest known sperm of a 100 million year old crustacean preserved in amber.
Oh, God.
Carrie, you're asking to go first.
So I guess so. Direct evidence that human ancestors were boiling food in hot springs 2 million years ago, 1 million years before the first evidence of cooking with fire. So basically, even before we figured out how to harness fire and use it as a tool, we were using passively using natural heat to cook food. That's the argument. 2 million years ago. So this would be, what species would this have been? Homo something. Yeah. Homo something from before. Erectus, maybe? I don't know. Scientists have discovered a new mass extinction. A new mass extinction. 233 million years ago, paving the way for the rise of the dinosaurs. So pre-dinosaur suppress other life. Dinosaurs took over. Paleontologists discovered the oldest known sperm. 100-year-old crustacean. That's hilarious. I hope that one's science. I'm going to say that one's science because it makes me laugh. So it's really between the first two. Which is more ludicrous? Direct evidence that human ancestors. What the hell could that be? Direct evidence. That feels like a loaded modifier. Direct. So are you saying irrefutable?
No. Direct does not mean irrefutable, but it just means it's not. We're not inferring it. It's not indirect evidence. It's like, yes, this was cooked, you know?
Gotcha. Okay. It was cooked. It was before we had fire.
Yeah.
WTF. Okay. That one seems the obvious fiction, but I want to say that the new mass extinction is the fiction because I feel like we've known about most of these mass extinctions for so long. Like, how did we overlook something like that? And maybe I would have heard more about it. So I'm going to say that the mass extinction is the fiction, but I don't know. Don't feel strong about it.
Jay?
First one about the archaeologists, they found people, like basically human ancestors cooking. You know, I mean, look, it's if the hot springs, it's a free energy source, you know, they don't have to carry fire around, which, you know, I'm sure is always a challenge back then. You know, it's like a way to cook. And it just takes one person, you know, to drop something in and it'd be like, oh, hey, you know, I dropped my chicken in here and, oh, chicken soup, you know, I mean, you can't, you know, the smell alone, you know, you'd be like, hey, whatever they were talking back then, they'd say, hey, yes, it's delicious. So I think that's probably science because, you know, again, the free, you know, source of energy. The second one here, the mass extinction occurring 233 million years ago. So you're saying that whatever creatures lived before the dinosaurs, there was a mass extinction of them that allowed the dinosaurs to rise. That's what you're saying, Steve?
That's what I'm saying.
Okay. Oldest known sperm. So you're saying that there is a sperm that's a 100 million old crustacean sperm preserved in amber. The whole amber thing. I don't know. That one just sounds like they're one of the things about it can't be true. I'm going to say that's the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, these are good, man. These are tough. So the hot springs 2 million years ago. 2 million years ago. I mean, talk about cold trail there. I mean,
exactly.
I mean, what? How do they distinguish humans cooking it to an animal that just slipped into the hot spring and boiled to death? Like, oh yeah, they must have been eating this. I mean, how do you distinguish between that? Like, I mean, I guess you could find it that it's some sort of site where early humans were living. I guess that's possible. And let's see, jump to the third one, 100 million year old crustacean sperm. Now we know that there's no way that there's going to be anything left of that sperm in terms of genetic data. 100 million years, even in amber, is just like, it's just way too degraded. But perhaps they can still identify that it was, you know, a sperm in amber. Even though the data is essentially gone. So that, I guess that's how I could justify that one in my head. But so let's go to the mass extinction. Yeah, that's just too much. It's not that, I mean, it's a long time ago for sure. But I mean, we've got extinctions going back so far that we know about. How did this one slip through the cracks? I'm trying to remember all the extinctions that we even talked about them just a few episodes ago. So yeah, I'm going to go with two, that the extinction one is fiction as well.
And Evan.
Boy, yeah, you'd think you would have heard something big about that new mass extinction. That's not a small news item. So I don't know. I was leaning towards that one. Although the other one about the boiling food in the hot springs, you know, don't this hot spring, how do you get near the hot springs to cook them? I mean, you can't really do that. Isn't there a kind of a physical limitation as how close you can get to these things that you can maybe just get to the edge of one and maybe, but if you needed the temperature in order to cook it, you probably needed to get to a point where a person couldn't be. So, boy, I think it's either that one or the extinction one. I guess I'll go with Kara and Bob and say it's the extinction one, but I wouldn't be surprised if the cooking with fire one is.
So you're fiction. Not going to strike out on your own this time, huh?
No, not this time. Right. I don't have my bravery pants on today.
So you guys all agree on number one, so I guess we'll start there. Yeah. Archaeologists have found direct evidence that our human ancestors were boiling food in hot springs almost 2 million years ago, 1 million years before the first evidence of cooking with fire. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is the fiction.
Of course it is. Man. Of course it is.
But they did because
that's the
so
way
is it
that
not
goes.
Direct evidence?
Yes, Kara, you were 100% correct. The direct, that one word was what really makes this fiction. So
you got to be kidding me. This one, really? That's it? The direct?
Yeah, that's huge. Direct evidence. So I'll tell you what they actually did.
It's almost
find.
An oxymoron. Direct evidence from 2 million years ago.
Exactly. Yet somehow we all were like, I guess it's plausible.
Well, okay. So hang on. It's not that crazy. So like, for example, I would say that we have direct evidence of cooking with fire 1 million years ago. We have a fire pit with bones of animals that we ate that were clearly cracked by fire. They were cooked in fire. And there are marks on them. That means that we were cutting meat off of the cooked bones, right? That's pretty direct evidence.
Yep.
Yeah, but 2 million is twice as much as 1 million.
That's true. Now, so this is what the archaeologists did find. They found evidence that maybe there were hot springs in the same location as people. That's it. Just that there were hot springs there. There's no evidence that we actually did any cooking, that we, whatever. That's all just complete speculation. But, of course, the speculation was the headline, so I was hoping to get somebody there. But the evidence is just that there were probably – and how do they know that there were hot springs there? Because they found evidence that there were bacteria there that were extremophiles and like to live in hot springs. That's it. So what they really found was bacteria, evidence of bacteria, which might translate into hot springs – which might translate into cooking at hot springs because it was an Olduvai Gorge where we knew people were. So they go, hot springs next to people. Maybe they were cooking.
Reach.
That's it. That's complete speculation. No direct evidence. Mm-hmm. But it wouldn't be crazy. It's just that there's no evidence that it actually happened. But what movie did that remind you guys of?
Oh, God.
Oh,
Caveman.
Caveman.
It had to be Caveman.
Remember they cooked a giant egg in a hot spring and had like a hard-boiled egg that they then ate.
No. Yeah. Right. Lobo.
All I got to say is Atuk Alundalana.
Oh, my gosh.
All right, let's go.
Kara, that movie, Ringo Starr was
Ringo
in that
Starr
movie.
Ringo Starr and Barbara Bach. Yeah.
I wonder if it holds
right
up.
There.
I have to say this because it just happened about a month ago. So we're looking for something to do with the kids. I'm like, oh, I have the DVD of Caveman. Let's watch it.
Oh, my God.
We got through 10 minutes of this movie, and my wife and my mother-in-law were looking at me like there was something wrong with me. I'm like, it's supposed to be cheesy. I mean, for crying out loud, Ringo Starr is it. It's
like
craptastic.
Every prehistoric trope you could imagine. All right.
What did you think, Jay? Never mind your wife and mother-in-law. What
did they make you
think?
Turn it off?
Huh. I mean, Bob, we saw the movie so many times when we were kids. Like, I knew every line, every move.
Right?
Everything was funny to
so
me.
Watchable.
The whole thing
it's
was
watchable.
Funny.
All right. Good. That's all I want to know.
A toque.
All right. Scientists have discovered a new mass extinction occurring 233 million years ago and paving the way for the rise of the dinosaurs. That is science. So that sounds like pretty big news.
Yeah.
And the dinosaurs were already around. This didn't allow for the emergence of the dinosaurs, but their rise from a fringe group to a dominant vertebrate group on the land. But also, this mass extinction resulted in a realignment of ecosystems into much more of the modern direction. So mammals also were arising at this time, for example. So there's a lot of changes that all happened right around this time. And like many of the other mass extinctions, they think it was probably due to a massive volcanic eruption, changing the climate, you know, CO2, global warming, changing the oceans, acidity, blah, blah, blah. And then everything died. Now, what's interesting is that when I was looking for, because I always like to like try to go back to find the original article, I just put into Google, you know, like new mass extinction discovered. And the first thing that came up was an article from 2019 talking about a different new mass extinction.
Hmm.
This one, 260 million years ago. So it's a completely different one. So the thing is, there's lots of mass extinctions. Like there's the big five. We call it the big five mass right. extinctions. But there's lots of other mass extinctions that are smaller. And it's just, it's kind of a continuum. So what do you consider one big enough to be one of the big ones? And so apparently the one that was proposed in 2019 as being the sixth major extinction didn't take, I guess, because that was the first I was hearing of it as one of the big ones, where it's just that the textbooks are slow to catch on. And now this news item is talking about, like, this is the sixth one now, and it completely ignores that a year ago a different mass extinction was proposed as the sixth mass extinction, whatever. So it's probably not as newsworthy as you might think. I think that mass extinctions are more common, and it's just a relative thing. Okay, all of this means that paleontologists have discovered the oldest known sperm of a 100-million-year-old crustacean preserved in amber. That one is science. This has kind of been making its way around the science newsosphere, so I wouldn't be surprised if any of you guys had seen this one. But it's well-preserved reproductive organs of a giant sperm in Cretaceous ostracods. Ostracods. Which apparently is a crustacean.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. Yeah, Bob, you're right. They probably don't have like viable DNA because DNA doesn't survive
down
that
over,
long.
Yeah.
But the cells are there, you know.
Yeah.
So that one is science. That's pretty cool. All right. So last week I gave you guys kind of an easy one. So this week I flipped the script a little bit.
Yeah, that was good. That was good.
You swept me last week. I swept you this week. It all balances out.
Leads back to Kara's news item about justifying positions and
other things.
Not really, but okay. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Isn't it enough to see that a garden is beautiful without having to believe that there are fairies at the bottom of it too? It was written by Douglas Adams, appeared in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Yep. And thank you to Damien from Brisbane, who suggested that quote for this week. I haven't done Douglas Adams in a while, so I thought it was good.
Yeah, we got to do him once a year or so.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely.
Kind of the inspiration for the name of our show. And I've heard many versions of that. Like, isn't the world magnificent enough without having to inject it with magic? Basically some version of that.
Right.
You know? Exactly. Absolutely. I know Carl Sagan said as much on more than one occasion, probably. And totally agree. The reality is so damn fascinating. Why do you want to fill it with our cheap fictions, you know?
Yep. Yeah, totally agree.
Yeah, yeah. All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thank you, Steve.
You got it, brother.
See you Friday.
We will see you at the Friday live stream, and who knows, maybe sooner than later, we'll see you at the 12-hour show.
Yeah. Jay, I want to say, that you are my Bobo. I hope you have some good ool tonight and that you engage in some zug-zug soon.
Oh, Kara, we're going to have to watch that movie.
I don't want to.
No, you don't.
Smile, Bob.
You don't. 90 minutes of your life, you'll never get back.
All right. Well, in addition to all that, until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.